Thank you very much. That was provocative and entertaining and thoroughly delightful. And I'm glad the pictures were finally available. That made a big difference, too. We're now going to hear very briefly from our two panelists. We'll give them just a few minutes each to respond, and then we'll turn to you for questions. Bob, would you go first?
Sure. It's hard to know where to begin with that, whether one should start with the leaves or with the roots. I think I want to just respond with two practical illustrations, I think, of the kind of thing that David was talking about, and only perhaps in a context of the agency that I'm familiar with, the Institute of Museum and Library Services. We, along with many other federal agencies, foundations, and other funders, have supported the creation of a lot of digital content over the past several years. And as you mentioned at the beginning, it's going pretty well. There's a lot of stuff out there. And what we have discovered in the feedback we get from the projects that we have funded is that people use this stuff in ways we never anticipated that they would. They don't come to it through the card catalog to find the a structured, systematic kind of approach to knowledge, but rather they encounter it serendipitously, perhaps through Google, but in links from all sorts of other kinds of approaches. And what they do is they capture those resources and bring them to their desktop, and they reorganize them in ways that meet their needs and interests. They repurpose the content, which museums and libraries and archives and other cultural institutions have preserved in very specific and structured kinds of ways. And they are not guided by the ways in which we have preserved and carefully organized and presented and sometimes interpreted for their use, but rather they put it together the way that makes sense to them. What we have found in response to that is that they're doing that in the digital world, but the digital world, the digital environment for cultural resources and learning resources doesn't answer all needs. People, you can get copies of the Declaration of Independence in a variety of different forms and formats. You can buy it for a couple of bucks out on the mall if you want to, and yet people still stand in line in the sun for a long time to go in to see the Charters of Freedom. There's a reason why they do that. The same thing holds true of, Renoir's Afternoon of the Boating Party, or, pick any object you want. The fact that you have ready access to it in digital form does not mean that you don't also want to, on occasion, have access to the authentic, the physical. And what we are finding is that people are finding these things from museums and libraries and archives and other kinds of sources. The Bettman Archive is another example. And that when they want to find the authentic, they all of a sudden encounter a host of barriers that they did not anticipate. If they're finding things and repurposing them for their own interests in the field of, broadly speaking, American history, and they take something from, they take an object from the National Museum of American History and a document from the National Archives and a photograph or an audio clip from the Library of Congress's collections and put them together to solve their own needs, and then they come to try to find the authentic, they discover that there are all kinds of impediments to that access. They're housed in different places. They're accessed through different processes and procedures. It's easier to get to the object if it's on display in the National Museum than it might be to get to the document, which is in the stacks of the National Archives. They might have to take the metro and the bus out to Archives 2 in College Park to get to it. And my point is that we need to think of ways to reduce those barriers in the real world as we have in the digital world. I think I could go on at great length about that, and I better stop before I take up too much time. I wanted to make one other initial comment, and that is your point about users contributing to the information. We actually have some really splendid examples of this in local history collections and libraries and museums, where we have have put up a photograph and say, who is this, you know, in the context of a little, and foster through that process a really interesting local community dialogue about not only who might be pictured in that photograph, but what's the context of it, what's its significance to the community, and draws in and really creates a whole new sense of community by engaging the audience, to use one of our constituents' favorite way of talking about people who use our resources. So I think that just highlights the kind of thing I think you're talking about.
I'd like to ask David a question. Libraries are watching all of this going on right now, and libraries tend to have a feat in both the present and in the future, because we're concerned about 50 years from now, looking back at 2004, what are people going to want to know about what was going on in this world, in this time? What do you think libraries should be doing now to capture all of this stuff that's going on, this messy web that's out there?
It can't ever be done fully. Mm-hmm. There are only incremental steps toward this. There's always going to be some request. The researcher wants to locate all books, not only written in German, that have more than one author, one of whom has a PhD, but who has red hair. And you just won't have that bit of information there. But trying to add as much information to the objects that are there, however that can be done. And user input is one, but libraries know a huge amount starting out on their own. The information objects have to be open-ended, because you never know what people are going to want to add to it later. You have a remarkable resource in a database of books. That's not a bad place to start, and those over time, those book catalogs have already been enhanced with more and more information. The adding of, as the content gets digitized, that turns out to be not surprisingly, a hugely important additional bit of data that's in the bundle. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't have a good system. I don't have a good systematic answer, but being open to non-systematic answers, I think, is a big part of it.
In addition to describing these things and adding to those descriptions, the Library of Congress is just starting a web archiving project. I mean, actually capturing this stuff and saving it for the future. And is that something you think libraries should be doing? Does it belong somewhere else?
Well, I think it's a great thing for somebody to be doing. I'm sure you know Brewster Kahle is, with the Wayback Machine, has been attempting to do something like that as well. The issue, of course, is that the web is dynamic. And even if it weren't, Google just upped the number of pages that it has indexed to 8 billion, basically doubled its size, but we have to suspect that that's still just a fraction of the available material. But no, I think it would be, I'm delighted to hear that. It would be a huge benefit, not only to the existing community, but historically, tremendous value in that.
Thank you, panelists. Thank you, David. Now we're going to turn to the audience and to the viewers and hear some of your questions. There is a microphone in the back that will be brought to you, and we'd like you to speak in the microphone so we can capture your comments. Let me begin with a question from one of the viewers, who asks, can you give words of reassurance to historians who have depended on written records in one form or another? What would you say to historians who use paper documents? And any one of you, Derek, maybe you have a thought about that.
Actually, while you were talking, I did have a historian issue. It's a site called Zeitenwende from Germany, which is always semi-functional, but the idea of the site is quite extraordinary, I think. It is for people to tell and show their testimony about the history of Germany over the last 100 years, and it's to tell them from their point of view and not from the point of view of a official historical record, but they have to be able to document what they're saying with whatever, you know, evidence they have digitized. And you travel into this map of the memory of Germany via datelines and geography so that you can actually choose different periods and even different weeks in the year and in different parts of a city, different areas. And you can navigate in it also, as you said, in some ways by different kinds of taxonomies, different kinds of orders. I believe that history, in fact, has itself changed very much under the influence of people who have been here. By the way, Fernand Braudel is one. History has moved from the sort of imposed order of the large events and the big characters and the big people to the small details and what were the core, you know, the core motivation of the life of a village, of the life of a certain type of profession, for example. And I think that to that extent, the new kind of multifaceted, the diamond kind of history writing, brings something more to historical process. But I also believe that, just as you were talking about the authority of the actual work of art or the actual book that was published, I believe also that a certain kind of opinion making in history is going to become much more valued than in the past, particularly when we abandon the illusion of objectivity. You know, I wanted to ask you this question. I want to respond to this question. The history of objectivity comes along with subjectivity. The history of the private comes along with the public. The Republic was invented to protect private property because it was the res publica, the public thing, and then people living in it had their private property. When people learned to read and write, they internalized, they literally appropriated language and internalized consciousness and privatized it, literally closed the door on it. The founder of our private consciousness is Prometheus. Prometheus is standing attached to a rock. He has no power, but the power that he has is to close his mind on a secret that Zeus wants to know, to have and doesn't get. That's the beginning of the Western mind. The Western mind is challenged by electricity, and all this content is not anymore divided into objective, subjective, and the objective of the past we have brilliantly been shown, Aristotelian categories, don't really work very well anymore. We don't have any real ground. We move from the solid to the liquid. We're in a post-Galilean moment right now, literally. Galileo was supposed to say the world, there was a solidity to the world that God couldn't touch. That was the whole idea. Now we realize, in fact, we're moving from a solid world to a liquid world. But my question to you would be, in the multijectivity or the polyjectivity that you were referring to, isn't the role of the blog, isn't the blog the first example or the first image of a connected identity as opposed to a private identity?
I think identities have always been connected. They've always been what we do in public in relation to others. And the notion of a hardened self that's independent of the world, and very much a traditional American ideal, in fact, of the...
And Greek.
We've taken up the idea of fierce independence, I think, and self-reliance more than most cultures have. And that, I think, is... We're seeing that fail. Yeah. It's failing in the face that... of a new, well, medium, where you get to build, everything that's there is built on purpose. There's nothing in the web space that wasn't built by someone or some company consisting of people in order to do something, in order to be connected to somebody else. So the selves that we are able to build and project on the web are necessarily, and not only necessarily, but unavoidably social. In a way that I actually think ourselves always were, but we were able to avoid it. On the web, why are you there unless you in some way care about connecting with other people? If you don't, then you're not on the web. That's fine. You don't have to. So the illusory notion that selves are sort of hardened M&M-like substances that exist essentially independent from everybody else cannot be support. You can't be on the web and support that idea very consistently anyway. It's a link. Web only exists, literally only exists because of the links.
But the blog,
links are primary.
The blog, more than the web, contains the expression, the so-called diary published online, And that's one thing. And you said that's not very important. In fact, that isn't very important. But that what is important is you have a list of the things that that person who has published is interested in looking at, you know, Joe blog, your blog. You have a list. We know where to go. But more than everything else is that fact that that comes with your network of people asking questions and referring. And this is this also messy extension of your own identity by the people who respond to you. That's what I'm talking about as a new form of identity that we hadn't known before, that we, for which we didn't have an image. We always knew about the self and the private self and everything in philosophy and novels and, you know, on the stage. But now we have a very different kind of relationship setting up.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think what blogs in particular, because much of that had been happening on the web anyway, what blogs add to it is the persistence. So links have always been the fundamental matter of the web, more than the content. Without the links, there is literally no web. Blogs give individuals a place in which to attach those links with persistence, and that is, I think, a significant change.
Turn now to the audience here and find out if you have questions. Lots of questions. Carolyn, we need a microphone here.
You've been talking a lot about issues of identity and culture, and you've been rooted in your conversation in Western culture. And I find myself wondering, since we know that identity gets constructed, at least this has been the sort of common assumption, it gets constructed in different cultures in different kinds of ways. And I wonder if you have any cross-cultural information or interpretation about how blogs get used differently in different places. And I'm just wondering, and I don't know if this is, we think of Japanese culture, certain Asian cultures, as being more collective in terms of how you construct identity and where the whole notion of the group or the collective is much better acknowledged than it has been in Western culture. So I find myself wondering, well, are there Japanese blogs? And what would they look like? And what would the conversations be like? And what would the constructions of identity look like, since we know the starting point of identity is different from the West?
Is a wonderful question to which I have a miserable answer. So, yes, it seems like it must be the case that, just as you suggest, that weblogs are going to be essentially different in different cultures, even though they're the same form and they may be using the same software, but that doesn't matter. It's the social role of them. And it seems like that must be the case. And I'm certain that it is. And there's a field that's growing. It's sort of just been named, which is internet sociology. I'm at the Harvard Berkman Center this year, and there are a couple of people there who are very involved in that sort of research. Ethan Zuckerman, for example, has a special interest in African blogs and the internet in Africa. It's an enormously important question that needs careful attention, and I have no answer.
Great. Let's have a question right here from this audience, and we'll move to the viewers.
A question for David Weinberger. A question is, the Usenet was around 10 years ago. We had Deja to index it. It's pretty much dead. It seems like there aren't too many more postings. Any thoughts on the Usenet or Deja?
Well, Usenet isn't quite dead. Google owns it. Owns Deja, not Usenet. All right, so they're indexing. Usenet is internet, the original internet discussion forums, and there are something like 70,000 of them still, something like that. Google has been indexing them for the past 4 or 5 years since they bought Deja News. So they're still, and they seem, from what I can see from the site, it looks like they're beginning to sort of push on that a little bit again also. So there's still some life in those. They were, and still are. I actually use them quite frequently. They're really valuable. With 70,000 topics the topics get fairly specific. As the volume of users grew, the number of topics splintered in order to be able to keep them relatively focused. So they actually turn out to be quite useful ways of posing questions and getting answers. They're used for other things as well, including famously flame wars. They've since the web came along, they have fallen into, they're not as central to the internet experience as they once were because they're not terribly user friendly in the way that some websites can be. But they're still kicking and they still serve a purpose.
Thank you. I'm now going to read a question from a viewer in Providence, Rhode Island, who asks, what advantages do blogs have over more traditional forms of information gathering, and what types of regulations will be put in place to ensure blogs are rich in content and worth reading?
Would you are the thought police listening? Because I'm not sure what the answer to get. They're distinguished from other information gathering media in that they're not primarily about information gathering. Often they are primarily about people connecting with other people, writing about what matters to them in response to this community of people who are reading them. It's quite a thrill to be read. You know, it's just that's again a type of intimacy to actually have your stuff be read by people you don't know, whether it's 100,000 or 500,000 like some of the more popular blogs, or 4 or 5, which is more typical as you go down the tail of 5 to 10 million people writing web blogs. To be read is an act of intimacy. It's not an act of information sharing. So what are the controls put in place for making sure that blogs are of high quality? None. It's really, really important, despite recent FCC findings. The control on weblogs is primarily if other people find you interesting. That's the motive. That's what pulls you through yet another entry. And it doesn't have to be a lot of people. It can be a handful of people.
There is something quite remarkable about getting an email message that says, you've been blogged. It's remarkable. Let's see. Are there questions over here? Back in Peg.
For both Robert and David, and my question really focuses on education. We've talked a lot now about libraries and trees of knowledge and so forth. How do you see the field of education maybe changing as a result of the blogging? And also for Robert, one of the reasons I was interested in this is because of your talking about museums, and you know museums have been used more than ever now in education. So how does that whole thing get put together?
You want me to go first?
Absolutely.
Well, I think the really, in the standpoint of education, I would actually try to recast your question in terms of not education but learning. The power of the blog is the way it empowers the development of, in an organic sort of way, of self-selecting communities of interest. And that can be done at every age level, above a certain threshold of being able to manipulate the mechanics that's required. And I think there's a substantial potential for really supporting the transfer of knowledge, learning, at all stages of learning, at all stages of life, by the creation or establishment or development of these kind of self-selecting communities of interest that dissolves the geographic barriers that have been the focus of education. I mean, education has, until very recently, been very definitely geocentric, place-centered. And now I think we face the prospect of having a sort of a global interconnectedness that allows people and empowers people to explore well beyond their previous limitations in terms of geography. Exactly how that will play out, I have no idea. But I think we're in for a really interesting ride.
I think it's getting more interesting as education goes down the no child messed around with line, where testing becomes the primary objective, it seems, in too many of our schools. There's always been, of course, a problem with schools sometimes tending towards confusing education with filling up with facts. And every parent, you know, has seen a little bit of that, at least. With the emphasis on testing, it's getting much, much worse. And so it's actually the clash is quite extreme. We are still generally educating children towards taking tests and doing well as individuals. And at the same time, our children are off doing their homework together because they're doing it on the computer, with word processing, of course. But if they're on the computer, they're on instant messaging. And if they're on instant messaging, they're talking with their friends. And what else are they going to talk about except what did you get for number six? So they're doing their homework together. And blogging, there's lots of experiments now using blogging in classrooms. One of the ones that I find really exciting is actually from Rebecca McKinnon, who's also at the Berkman Center. These are all people whose blogs you should be reading, by the way, who found one at Georgetown, I believe. It was a class blog. That is, a class had set up a blog. Many blogs are group blogs. They're not all by individuals. Some of the best ones are, in fact, written by bunches of people. So this is a blog that's created for a class. Anybody in the class can contribute, and you read through it, and here are students who are pulling in items off the news and saying, oh, I just read this. You know, the topic is, the thing was a poli-sci class, and they're pulling in stuff about North Korea and commenting back and forth on it, and somebody blogs about this, or how they, I read this in the reading material, but I disagreed with it, here's what I think, and somebody responds to that. What more could you want? What more could you want from your class that they're doing that on their own? It's all like total extra credit without even, you know, credit. So it can turn into a really exciting environment in which people learn together.
Okay, can I add something to that? Because I'm fascinated by this question of education, and I think it has major consequences in terms of blogs, not just blogs, but SMS, all the media that the children can use among themselves, or change three things at least. Changes authority. Every time that a new medium comes, authority changes. I can remember reading about this fantastic research done by a chief librarian in the Newberry Library about medieval text authority and how students in universities could read a text and criticize in the background, in the back of the class, they could actually criticize the professor who used the authority of the voice. That was the authority of the Middle Ages. And then suddenly the authority of the text challenges the authority of the voice. So that's a major change. SMS and blogs do the same. And teachers are very wary of this. And they realize that what they have to do is the second big change, which is that they have to move to collaborative practice. They get their kids to work together and do work together and build. Then that's the third one. Building knowledge together, collaborating, and then spreading and sharing the authority. I think these are very key changes that are happening in the educational system now, and you'll find that there'll be more of that rather than less.
So let's move back to this audience in the back.
Do you see Christianity being threatened or challenged or emasculated as we go from the Dewey Decimal System to the Internet? And do Judaism and Islam and Buddhism feel empowered, at least in libraries or on the web? And did Howard Dean find out that Job was his favorite New Testament book from a blog or the Internet rather than from an actual Bible?
Maybe several questions in that one.
Yes, and let's see. First of all, you're asking the wrong Christian. I'm a Jew. I've never heard anybody complain about the Dewey Decimal System's ordering on religious grounds. It's just sitting there sort of unobserved, and I don't think anybody cares. So, no, I don't think that the Dewey Decimal System constitutes an assault on any particular religion. I'd like to go on the record about that. As for Howard Dean's Book of Job, beats me. Yeah.
Did he find it after he lost it or before?
Did he at one point get asked, what's your favorite book, and say Job, or was that just a sardonic comment?
Well, it was also he inaccurately represented Job as being in the New Testament. That was my understanding during the campaign. But I also was just concerned about how accurate and how trustworthy can we rely on blogs and the Internet.
You cannot rely on any blog to be trustworthy. But you can rely upon the collection of blogs to be quite trustworthy. And in fact, well, I hesitate to say this, but in the in many ways, I'm going to regret saying this, but it's with the qualification, it's true. In many ways, I trust weblogs, the collection of weblogs, more than I trust the news media. Certainly more than I trust televised news. Sorry.
Well,
weblogs are self-correcting, and they frequently go wrong, but frequently they are also corrected.
David, this is another question from a viewer in Brookline, Massachusetts, who says he's a neighbor, and asks this question: will we see a collaborative rating system which can help researchers quickly ascertain the reliability of what they're reading? This, again, gets to the authority and reliability question.
It's impossible. We might. We already have rating systems. It's pretty much called email. Email is a global recommendation system by which we say, oh, this, you got to see this. I know you're interested in this stuff. Here's something you ought to read. So email and weblogs are already a type of recommendation system. The problem with rating systems is the same as the problem with universal categorization schemes, which is they don't, as they get larger and larger, they become less attuned to the individual values that they're supposed to be representing. So the possibility of having a universal rating system is, it would be useless if it were universal. So we might well see local rating systems. That is, I'm actually more interested, I'm not so much interested in what everybody on the web thinks about Ken Moore or Howard Dean or whatever. I'm much more interested in the set of people who I know one way or another, what they think. So a rating system that worked across local communities, virtual communities, that would be more interesting to me. Who knows what's going to be invented is really the question. No.
I know there's still lots of questions and time is running out.
Is this on?
Yes.
Hi. My name is Carrie Carpenter. I'm actually an internet sociologist from the University of California, Irvine, and actually I was an embedded researcher with the Howard Dean for President campaign. I worked on the web team and I helped out with the weblog. So one of the things that I'm interested in is not only there's this notion that blogs are sort of an atom of conversation. Most of the times blogs are one person, one voice, and then there's other people who comment or point to other people's weblogs. And I think it's sort of fundamentally changed with the Howard Dean campaign, where you had multiple people writing on the same blog and in a community of thousands and thousands of people commenting around the blog. And also how that plays out into political action and whether or not a campaign will be successful or will not be successful when blogs are in play. So how do you, since you were one of the internet advisors for the Howard Dean campaign, how do you see Howard Dean's experience and particularly Howard Dean's weblog changing politics or changing the way that politics get played?
Oh, if only. a couple ways. The first is that we're used to having two voices who speak for a campaign. You have the candidate and you have the press secretary. You had Howard Dean, you had Tricia Enright, right? And everybody else can't speak for the campaign. The Dean campaign hired this guy, Matthew Gross, and then a bunch of more bloggers, who's a kid, you know, he's 31 and at the time. And this is a guy who writes a weblog on the site, on the Howard Dean site. It becomes the focus of the Howard Dean website, which was the focus in many ways of the Howard Dean campaign. And it's just this guy. And it works because he's somebody who speaks in his own voice and sort of speaks for the campaign, but sort of doesn't speak for the campaign. And we've never had a third voice in a campaign before. Now, the second thing is much harder to get at, but I think you'll know what I mean anyway, which is in ways that are really hard to describe. You had postings every day on the Howard Dean weblog by a number of people. We got to know them. We liked them. We trusted them. there were comments. You could comment on each of the entries. There would be 400 in an hour, easily 400 comments posted. There were people who posted regularly into the comments. The Dean campaign was very generous with the other links on their page to hundreds of other weblogs. 394, thank you very much. Approximately 394, I'm told. People who got their links onto that page felt like this was their blog, that the Howard Dean blog was their blog. People who are regular contributors to the comments would get recognized by other people. This was their blog. And not only did it feel like their blog, even if the community felt knitted together by this community of voices. You felt like you already knew the people in the campaign, and that was tremendously invigorating in a way that most political campaigns are tremendously demeaning. You know, here's the message, you're the foot soldiers, go door to door and repeat the message. You might as well be selling Tide or something. Dean campaign, because it was willing to give up some control of the message and because it used the weblog and other techniques, but to allow voices, our voices, to emerge, not just the official voice of the campaign, which traditionally is too tight and boring anyway. Because it allowed our voices to emerge, we formed a movement around it, one by one. And that was amazing. And I missed that very, very much in the rest of the campaign, the Kerry campaign.
Do you think that it will be done the same in future campaigns? One of the things that I've seen...
You need my microphone.
One of the things that I've seen in the Kerry campaign in particular, I guess I shouldn't really be casting aspersions, but that the weblog was not cast in the same light and that people didn't use the technology in the same way. So basically one of my fundamental questions is I think that what we did in the Dean campaign was inviting people into the message and giving people the autonomy and the authority to go out and do things on behalf of the campaign that turned it in from a political campaign in the traditional sense to a political movement.
I'm going to interrupt and give people a final chance. We're running out of time, and I think we're getting into another kind of speech. So if you don't mind, I'm going to move to the back and ask for the speaker back there.
Hi. When I look, Dr. Weinberger, at your four differences between digital info and traditional info, I'm struck by how that does or does not differ from a more traditional discourse. For example, if you have a history student who goes to southern France and reads the archives from former French colonies in Africa and is praised for pulling together little bits of disparate information and uses this information for their own purposes. And let's say this scholar uses information from a court trial that was used to convict somebody of stealing, but then they use the information to do a study about migrant farmers. And then they write a dissertation, they publish a book, and then somebody writes a book review on that, and that gets published in a traditional journal. That seems to cover all four of the areas you brought up. So I'm wondering if, aside from the speed with which it can happen on the internet and the amount that can happen on the internet, if there's any fundamental difference, particularly when you consider that a billion people still don't have web access.
5 billion people. 5 billion people don't have web access. Right? Maybe a billion optimistically do. You're absolutely right. And I don't mean to say there's nothing new. We're not capable of novelty. We're stuck with what we have. So I'm not saying that this has never happened before. What I'm suggesting maybe is that you don't have to be a grad student studying French history, go to the south of France, go through the records, that every one of us do it every time we go to a site. That it is, in that sense, it is simply a matter of more often by more people. It lowers the barriers to knowledge so dramatically that knowledge actually, the authority of knowledge shifts hands. It goes from experts to voices in conversation, and those voices are everyone's. So in some sense, that's simply a matter of quantity. But in fact, it's I believe that it's a substantial difference in the, both the shape of knowledge and the politics of knowledge as well. Not entirely new, of course not.
I'm going to ask another quick question from a viewer in Fairfax, California. Can blogs be used as evidence in court?
Of insanity, perhaps. I don't know.
Okay. Interesting question. All right, Arthur, let's...
Well, I do hope that 50 million bloggers can do better than 50 million Frenchmen. But I'm wondering, so they had a conversation this week with a very interesting woman who has been hired by the Chinese government to organize a program to train one-third of the population to speak English in the next 12 years. And given that's a truthful statement, or even if it's not, what would it mean if we no longer, quote-unquote, own our language, if a billion Chinese or other people in the world speak English, which is our common tongue? What does that do to our language? What does that do to our communication? How does that change our world?
It's a great question, again, to which I have no answer. But it's, I'm really glad you... Okay.
I would suggest that we don't own our language now. That may be what the trend you're suggesting may be a difference of quantity, but it's certainly not a difference of quality. I've had the experience in the last year of participating in a number of international conferences at which it's very clear that English is, to coin a phrase, the lingua franca of these kinds of discussions, and everyone has their language and English. And I think it's very clear that we no longer, if we ever did, we certainly no longer own English as a proprietary thing. We don't control the development of neologisms. We do not control the way discourse is shaped. If we ever did, we certainly don't any longer.
This is, it's been a subject of anxiety for quite a while, that either the control of the empire of English on the world or the loss of that empire. And on the internet, if you read Wired regularly, which I did, after a while you realize that this was constantly evolving. Online, English was actually losing ground. It began by being something like between 90 and 100% of all languages used online, and gradually fell down to 80 and then 60, and I think now it's somewhere around 57 or something like this. It's still dominant, but it's very normal for this to happen. The question is very interesting, though. The question that teaching English to one-third of the Chinese population is an enormous challenge, I think, but let's say that it actually works. Would it be really different than Robert just said that the common use of English, in fact, is creating, without threatening the identity of the people who are using the language as a second language, it is creating a common ground. The wonderful thing about English is it can do that, and it does this reasonably well, and the anxiety over the imperialistic dominance of English over the rest, in fact, hasn't materialized. The only question that I'm asking myself is that there was one time when Latin was just like that. Latin was the lingua franca, was the dominant, and see where it got. So
it had a good run.
And,
let's have one final question from the lady in the back.
I actually wanted to turn back to the issue of what this can mean for libraries and the Library of Congress, so maybe it's fortunate that I can turn things in a circle that way at the end. But I just got back from a conference of the American Studies Association this past weekend where I happened to be in a session about virtual communities and the whole question of real versus virtual, and then also was lucky enough to attend a very excellent session about, it was called What Can American Studies Do for Libraries and What Can Libraries Do for American Studies, but it certainly by extension would be the humanities and social sciences, what can we do for each other. And what I'd like to sort of raise a question and then turn it back to you for a, or raise a, make a point and then turn it back to you for a question, which is, it seems to me that some of the suggestions you're making about the big revolution that we're seeing with blogging in particular, it depends on your reference frame, because Usenet was the big revolution 15 years ago, and Moz and Muds and other real-time environments were the big revolution. And even now you have what I actually was talking about at the conference, were online social networks like Friendster. What's interesting, though, is that depending on the time frame and also the scope, your users may or may not actually control the shape of knowledge, because in a system like Friendster, you just get one page and someone else decides what the page will look like. And even with blogs, most people are using prepackaged software, and unless they go to the length of learning how to do it themselves, they're the software underlying is still challenging the form. Now, if I can extend that to the library, we are working very hard to digitize primary materials from the past so that more and more users around the country and the world can see the original and interact with it directly. At the same time, what you're suggesting to us is that we're moving from a model where there's a single evidence-based reality to a social reality, and that rather that knowledge is becoming more of a social reality. And so we in libraries are offering the first kind of reality. If we show them the original Declaration of Independence, they can sort of grok it immediately, versus the kind of knowledge that's being developed in blog communities, which is a social reality. And so I'm wondering how you see that whole issue of realness playing into what's happening on the web. Where is it real and where is it not so real?
So you're ending with, what is reality? I don't mean to suggest that that the internet is allows for a purely social construction of reality apart from what's actual in the world. And I'm going to use the terms loosely because that's all I can do. Okay, it's certainly the case that much of what you see in the web logs and elsewhere are reactions to or comments on what's showing up in the media as objective fact. That's a lot of, so there is, and always will be, an intermingling, one refracting the other. I think it's way, and I think you probably agree, that it's way too simple, would be way too simple to say libraries represent objectivity and the old world, and blogs represent socially constructed reality and the new world. There's only one world. And there are various ways and media of refracting on it. The web and weblogs have certain strengths and certain, it's not just strengths, a certain form. They form the discourse in a particular way. Real-world libraries form the discourse in a different way. Those things will always be mingled, especially as you're digitizing the texts. It's an enormously useful thing to do.
Well, it's clear that we could continue these questions and discussions for a long time, but I'm afraid the evening must come to a close. So let me thank David Weinberger for an excellent talk. We do appreciate it very much.